Buoni, decido, c'è. Mr. Rachel.
Thank you. On behalf of the subcommittee, apologies to our guests that we are starting late and that the chair is arriving late. I would like to nominate Honourable Jackie Mofokeng to be the temporary chair until chair of the subcommittee arrives. Thank you.
Okay, Honourable Jackie Mofokeng is elected. Are there any further nominations? Okay, in the absence of any further nominations, can Honourable Jackie Mofokeng take the chair so that he can proceed? Thank you.
Good morning, everyone, and my apology for running late because the buses today are not in order. But also an apology of the and then we also have an apology of the chair, as you've been told, and also Honourable Scholar. But with that, can we start our meeting? May I actually look at it?
Could I just raise something before we start? Some time ago, I asked the inspecting judge whether he could investigate a video which I received from some inmates from Kosimapura Correctional Centre in Tshwane. And apparently the DCS has done an investigation of this matter. And the inspecting judge doesn't feel free to pass on that report directly and would rather pass it on to the committee. I wondered whether we could take a formal resolution in that respect so that we can fulfill our oversight responsibility.
What do you suggest that we do now?
Just simply ask the National Commission if he would in fact report available to us.
National Commission, how do you feel about it? Because I think it's a procedure.
Sorry, thanks, Chairperson. I didn't hear which report this is.
This is a report of alleged collusion between staff and inmates regarding a practice, I believe, known as Bluetoothing, where prisoners inject each other with their own blood in order to get a high from drug usage. And I believe that an investigation was carried out, and it would be very nice to have the report.
I'll have to locate that report and then I'll revert back to the committee.
I would suggest that as we are busy, maybe try to communicate with your office and so that we can take a decision before we close the meeting. I think that will be in order. Thank you very much, Honourable. Can we look at the agenda today? We are going to be looking at item number 3. But before we start, is there anything that you want to declare on your part or everything in order? Can we maybe start by introducing the team that are in the commission?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Arthur Fraser, the National Commissioner. Then I'll get my colleagues to introduce themselves.
My name is William Lomondlovu. I'm the Deputy Commissioner responsible for the remand detainees.
Good morning. Joseph Katanga. I'm responsible for strategic management.
Good morning, I'm Tando Pazewa. I'm responsible for offender sending management. Morning, I'm Tando Pazewa. I am responsible for offenders who are serving life sentences.
Morning, colleagues. I'm Nhlanhla Moremi. I'm responsible for parole administration.
Morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Veli Sombanda. I'm responsible for social integration.
My name is Hani Hendricks. I'm a member of parliament.
Good morning, Werner Hohn, member of parliament and the committee.
Good
to himself, likewise.
Good morning, Wilma Nyehoe-Truken. I'm an alternate member of the subcommittee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. As I've been introduced, I'm Jacqueline Mofuke. I'll be acting on behalf of the chairperson. Thank you. Any other person that you should introduce or introduce? Okay. Thank you very much. I would suggest that we have three presentations, and for us to be in order, and noting that honorable members, we do have a sitting today, am I right, that we have to join. So I would expect us that to make 10 o'clock for the members to join the parliamentary sitting, I would expect that you do the summaries, because we received the reports earlier, so that we can be able to run on all of them. I think I'm in order, members. Are you comfortable with that? Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Ms. Mlomo Ndlovu will lead us with the remand presentation, and then Ms. Moremi will lead us with the parole.
Thank you, Chair, and the honorable members. My first presentation will be on remand detainees with bail of less than 1,000 rand. But I decided to expand this presentation and not only focus on those who are with a less than 1,000 rand. I will just do a brief overview first so that you can understand where do we position the remand detainees. The remand detainees, they fall under the categories of unsentenced, and they constitute a third of the inmate population in the Department of Correctional Services, and they are detained in 125 facilities. Okay, then when it comes to bail categories, the bail categories that we keep in our facilities as per the warrant of detention that we receive from court is the athlete to appear in court for the first time where no bail application has been made, is those with bail that has been approved and fixed at a certain amount, and those with bail application in process. And then there is a category that falls under the bail application that has been considered and denied, and this also is a huge population. And then also we've discovered that there is another population amongst the RDs. There is another category that we're not aware of. They are these who do not want the bail application process to be entertained. Then let me go to the other slide. The other slide is just to give an overview of the remand detainee population over the period of 3 years they got this. If you see there's an upward trend from March 2017 up to March 2019, there's a gradual increase. But let's go to the second slide. And then the other slide is just to show the regional distribution. The first two regions is Gauteng and Western Cape, and then the second pair is KwaZulu-Natal and LMN. And then the last one is the Eastern Cape and Free State Northern Cape. So they normally go in pairs, and then those pairs, they shift. At times, Western Cape would be number one and Gauteng would be number two. You can see how that line is shaped. Okay, then the next slide. The next slide is just to show the January trend. Every January, the population of remand detainees goes up. You can see the highlight was wrong. I was supposed to have highlighted all RDs. January 2018, there were 46,000, but January 20, they are in 52,000, but they are less than the highest population that we have had historically. In our trend, it was 55,000. Then the next slide. And then there, this one is on the legislative and policy framework, which applies with people that we detain with the option of bail. We do have the Criminal Procedure Act, Section 63, which allows the Department of Correctional Services to approach the court to request for the amendment of bail for certain categories of RDs, but the head of the center can only utilize it if his prison population such propositions that it constitute a, I want to read it correctly, it constitute a material and imminent threat to human dignity, physical health or safety of the accused. But also it applies to us these with bail that have been charged with Schedule 7 crimes. And also those RDs also must be, their cases must be at the lower courts, that is the magistrate and the regional court. And then for that 63A, then we develop a bail protocol, which is a cluster policy, which outlines all the processes that we have to utilize from submission, from identifying the qualifying RDs to submitting the applications in court and also to making a follow-up so that we can know the court decisions. And then the next one, move, I've already done 63A. Okay, there's another section also of the Act that we use, it's 63.1. With 63.1, it's only the accused or the prosecutor that can consider, can apply for bail review in court. But in DCS, we do use it, but we are dependent on the permission from the remand detainee. If the remand detainee does not want to grant permission for us to submit the application, there's nothing we can do. Then the bail payment, it can be paid in court or it is paid in DCS facilities. But if people want to come and pay bail over the weekend, those arrangements have to be made with the center where the RD is detained. But before the bail is paid, the bail amount, we also check with the RD if the RD is satisfied with the person that is paying bail, because at times it's not safe. A person that pays bail is a co-accused who is placed under non-custodial. So for the protection, we check. If the RD says no, then that bail payment process does not continue. Go to the next one. Okay, here these are the bail categories in terms of the amount. So this is the one-day snapshot analysis from 31 on the day or on the date of 31 December. Yeah. Then if you look there, we heard about the cases. They were 7,289. What does it mean with the cases? Some RDs had more than one case. Yeah. So those that had bail of less than 1,000 runs, they constituted 75%, 1,000 to 5,000, 22%. Above 100,000, there were only two RDs. The highest paid amount, based on that snapshot, it was 300,000, and the lowest paid amount was 100,000. Let's go to the next slide. The next slide, this is the head count, not cases. In terms of the total number of RDs that had bail, they were 7,220. Still, those that had bail of less than 1,000 rand, they constituted almost 76%. Then let's go to the next slide. Then the next slide there, that's then unpacking in terms of the regional distribution of the RDs with bail of 1,000 rand and less. You can see the highest amount of bail, if you look at that slide, is 500 rand. Yeah, the 500 rand, or 44.71 of RDs have got a bail of 100 rand, and then is followed by 1,000 rand at 30%. The 100 rand, they have really dropped. Let's go to the next slide. Yeah, the 100 rand also, it was the cases and then the head count. Then we can skip that one. And then, of the population in DCS that is detained with bail, of the remand detainees that we detain, it's less than 20% that have got bail, which means a greater population that we keep, they do not have bail at all. Yeah. And of those with bail, some do not even qualify for us to submit applications to court. Yeah, because their crimes, they fall outside of the Schedule 7. So even though we use Section 63.1, if prisoners do not want us to use that, there's nothing we can do. So let's go to the next one. And then the next one is just to summarize the bail review application process of submitting our applications to COD 2015-16, 2017-18, 2018 and 2019-20. You can see the success rate is very poor. It's below 50% in 2018-19 and 2019-20. But fortunately, we had a session with the magistrates in Pretoria, which was held last month. We made a presentation on all the challenges that we have regarding to BASE. We also shared this slide so that they can see that if they do not really assist us by really approving our application, it becomes difficult for us to down-manage the population of remand detainees. Yeah, because there are limited strategies that we can utilize. Then go to the next one. We were given an assignment by the previous minister, Minister Matsuta, to just do an audit of the RPs that stay longer than 3 months, though they have got bail. Then what we found, there are three factors here that were playing a role. One was the affordability. Go to the next slide. Yeah. It was bail affordability. 90.32% could not afford bail. And then the unemployment with 64.22% and lack of family support was 87.68%. Our sample was 341 RDs detained with the option of bail at Amtata, Portsmouth Female and Portsmouth Remand. We decided that we're not going to replicate this study because normally the background of most of our population is similar. And when we look also at the bail, at the unemployment, we unpacked it in detail. A lot of them, they are coming from families where no one is employed. Yeah, because we were checking who is employed in the family. Is it a granny or who is really supporting the person? The picture was very bad. It was only a grandma that was the breadwinner in the family. So let's go to the next one. Then the assistance here is we need to educate the communities with regard to the purpose of bail, because we know in South Africa, once you have been arrested, people believe that you have to go behind bars, even if you're a romantic detainee, and that is going to increase our population. And then also our communities, they need to learn about the non-custodial. You can be on a pre-trial phase and placed on the non-custodial. So, and also there are options such as the police bail, warning and placement under supervision by the correctional official. Thank you. I've done with my first presentation.
Okay. Thank you very much. Can we go to the next one so that we can package all the questions with the members? Welcome, Honorable Mohammed.
Okay. The second presentation is on remand detainee children. Remand detainee children, they constitute less than 0.3% of the remand detainee population, and this gradual decrease we observe it since 2010 after the introduction of the Child Justice Act. Okay, that slide is just showing the trend in children that are detained in remand detainees, including the remand detainees. You can see our highest number of the remand detainees, and now we're for 2018, our annual average was 91. Yeah, but the figure also based on the daily unlock is even less than 91 now. Okay, but let's go to the next slide. Then that one is just a trend for the March period, the 1 March 2017, 2018, and 2019 in terms of the age groups, 14, 15, 16, and 17. So you can see, if you look at March 2019, our highest in terms of age is those that are 17 years. But when you look at March 2017, our highest was those that are 15 years. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Then the next slide is the legislative and policy framework that applies to the children. I think I will skip that slide. Let's go to the next one. And then let's go, yes, yeah. Then what is critical for us is the Child Justice Act. The Child Justice Act, it treats children differently. They have to appear in court every 14 days. So as the Department of Correctional Services, we have to monitor their warrants. Their warrants must have an interval of 14 days. Then let's go to the next one. And also in the Child Justice Act, there are factors that have to be considered by the presiding officer before a child is sent to our facilities. So at times people expect us to remove these children from our facilities. Because there's that provision in the law, it makes it difficult. If we are saying these children must be removed, it will appear as if we are saying the presiding officer didn't consider those factors, because it's a list of factors that the presiding factors has to be considered. So also the Child Justice Act acknowledges that there is a category of children that will be sentenced and be detained in DCF. Yeah. And then let's go to the next slide. And then the Correctional Services Act, Section 19, it makes provision for the programs that have to be provided to children. These programs also, they include the remand detainee children. Let's go to the next slide. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, no, but let's go back to the international laws. Yeah, what is provided for in the international laws? With regard to the international laws, it's saying that the services that should be provided to RDs is the continuity in education and training in line with the government policy, safety of persons, access to social welfare services, access to state-provided health, access to visits, communication and correspondence with family and friends, access to recreational and reading sources, and access to legal representation. All those are catered for in the policies of our department. And so the remand detainee children have got an access to those services. Then the guiding principles, the RDs have to be presumed innocent. As such, they can't be provided with the rehabilitation programs. They have to be given programs that are not going to focus on their cases. And then also another challenge with the RDs, they are in very unstable population whose length of detention is not known. So which means while they are exposed to the program, they can really pull out of the program at any time. Once with the children RDs, they are going to court every 14 days. So the priority at times is to prioritize their court reappearance. And then in as much as we have to encourage these children to attend also the program, the biggest challenge with the remand detainees will pick up that some children have never been to school. And then they enter in DCS. The program of education in DCS is quite different from the one that is provided outside. And also another challenge is that more than 50% of these children, they stay for a period of below 6 months. Yeah, because their cases are prioritized. Once you see the figure, that is not a stable population. It has got a changing phases. Yeah. But I will summarize with you, we did an audit just to check the children that were not attending school. What are the causes? Because it worries us that most of the children are not attending school. Then let's go to the next slide. Next, I will just talk about the educational program. Next. Yeah. Oh, okay, yes. We conducted an audit. And then there, what we discovered, that we interviewed 30 children. These were 30 children that were, it was Paul Smith, yeah. And I think some were in KwaZulu-Natal, okay. 17 were not attending school before arrest, and 13 were attending school. All three females in Paul Smith were attending school. And of the 13 children who were attending school, 3 were in grade 7, 3 were in grade 8, 6 were in grade 9, and 1 was in grade 10. But let's look to the next slide. And then there were children also that were not attending school. Of the 17 children that were not in school at all, 1 child had never been to school. 16 children did not attend school at some stage in their lives, but had left school. The reason cited for not attending school, they did not want to go to school, was one, don't know was one, gang-related, head of gang was one, had a calling to be a sangoma was one, no money for school fees, it was school for stabbing fellow Tutsi. It was one, was bullied one, and was in an accident one. So for us then it becomes a big problem, because in which program then do we put these children who have never been to school? But let's go to the next slide. And then the other programs, like I've mentioned, these children, they attend the social work, the spiritual care programs, the psychological programs. Most of the children, they normally don't book the psychological programs, but the first level of entry is the social workers, because social workers are in all the centers, of which the psychologists are not available in all the centers. But if there's a need for psychological intervention, the psychologist will be transferred to a center where the prisoner is detained. Then let's go. And then there are also other programs like the sports, recreation, arts and culture. The RB children, because of being at security risk of escape, they don't participate in outdoor programs. All the programs in which they participate is indoor. Yeah. I think I've mentioned all the other factors. Let's go to the last slide. Yeah, I think that's all.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think now the chairperson is back. We'll proceed with the next presentation.
Who's next, Commissioner?
Does not have to apply for parole.
So during that process, we think the basic factors that we focus on is the completion of the legislative required minimum detention period. We also look at the proof that rehabilitation and development took place, positive report on conduct and behavior, as well as the interventions did take place. Risk poses to the community should that offender be released, and victims must also be assessed and must have been reduced and managed appropriately. We're also looking at the comments made by the judge who imposed the sentence. We look at the previous convictions of the offender, the nature of the current offenses, as well as the previous convictions, the duration of sentence, age of the offender, crime patterns, results of assessment by experts, as well as the availability and quality of support system in the community. And of course, if the offender was found to be a suitable candidate to be placed on parole, they will also need to accept the parole conditions that are being set to them. Victim participation in parole court, it is a crucial part of the parole process. And the offenders, the victims at that time are invited to participate in the parole board hearing that is mandated by the law, and we are making reference.
Why not found it? Because we're not following you, but now we have the slide. Somebody is catching up. Continue. Because we want to make sure we you don't read and something we don't see where it is. You can continue. I'm sure it's not your fault. It's the one who's pressing. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry about that. Victim participation in parole boards is mandated by the Criminal Procedure Act, Section 299A, as well as the Correctional Services Act, Section 754. So the people who are required to participate in the victim participation during the parole process is the victims, is the victims of those that were murdered, the ones that were raped, robbery, and assault of sexual nature, as well as kidnapping. However, that is not only limited to those. Any victim who comes and registers that he wants to participate in the parole board proceedings, they are allowed to do so. So we have 53 audiovisual systems in all the parole boards, which is also one of the mechanisms that we are using in order for the victims to be able to participate in the parole board hearing. So during that process, we'll also require the victim impact statement, the statement of opposition, as well as the statement whereby the victims will have a platform to assist in prescribing or a setting of the parole conditions. So the victims can make their representation in the parole board through the written submission, the audio recording, audio-visual system, and they can also be physically there during the parole board sitting. However, they do not have the voting power. Okay, I will also zoom into the challenges regarding the victim participation in the parole board. Currently, we are having few cases that are registering in the parole to be part of the parole processes. And another thing that we are experiencing challenge on is some victims will change address after the crime has been perpetrated against them. some of the trace victims refused to participate in the parole processes because support was not provided to them immediately after crime was committed. On the other hand, some victims will wait until placement has been approved before making their voices heard, and this leads to negative reporting by the media. However, if we receive such, we ensure that we refer that matter for review. So the mitigations that we are putting in place to ensure that victims are participating in our parole board hearings is through the audiovisual systems that were that were installed in all parole boards. And there were also the auxiliary workers that were appointed to assist with the tracing of the victims. And then sharing of information on victim participation in the parole process in strategic places such as courts and during the correction week events is also assisting. And during the where parole board members and the community corrections participate in the forums of the community policing, victim empowerment, stop theft forums, imbizos and other community structures. So I will then move to the cases. I will share with you the information on the cases of the notorious cases. So the notorious cases will also include the high-profile cases. So we are saying here, notorious cases are identified during admission and correctional centers or during the serving of sentence, and the following are possible reasons for declaring offenders as notorious. So we are looking at the type of crimes that they have committed, circumstances under which the crimes were committed, status of victims, when crimes were committed, political standing of offender or the victims, the social standing of the offender or the victims, as well as the media coverage that was given to that particular case. So currently, nationally, we have a total of 434 cases. And I will move to the possible review of the minimum detention periods of offenders that are serving of offenders related to gender-based violence. Due to the stage that the country is currently experiencing and the pronouncement that was made by the president of the country in the joint sitting on the 18th of September 2019, that those who are found guilty of such crimes should not be eligible for parole. This followed his address to the public on the 5th of September 2019, where the issue of parole was also raised. So this, the discussion document was compiled in that regard, and as a department, we had sought legal advice to see that this can stand the constitutional muster. However, we were referred to the case law of Bull that was issued by the Supreme Court of Appeal, where they remarked that it is the possibility of parole which saved the sentence of life imprisonment from being declared a cruel, inhumane, and degrading punishment. In view of this judgment, referring to the sentence of life imprisonment, it is conceivable that a long determinate sentence without the possibility of parole or day parole may be deemed cruel, inhumane, and degrading as contemplated in Section 12(1)(e) of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. So there were two options where the department has sought the legal opinion on. So the other one was whether it would be feasible to review the minimum detention to two-thirds of for offenders to be considered upon completion of two-thirds of their sentences before parole can be considered for offenders who have committed this similar offences. So we were advised that the second option was the viable one. So that section will be aligned to the Criminal Procedure Act, Section 276B, where the Criminal Procedure Act provides for the setting of the minimum detention period or the non-parole period, which is not exceeding the two-thirds of the sentence. So I will move, I will only zoom on a few challenges and mitigations here. I will focus on the court judgment, which found some of the provisions of section of Correctional Services 111 of 1998 relating to parole to be unconstitutional. So the mitigation there was that a task team, particularly this section, is referring to the matter of the Parker judgment. A task team has been appointed to review the Correctional Services Act, including the provisions relating to parole. Section 136.1 will be amended within 24 months as per the Constitutional Court order. And then the Commission of Aggressive Offences by some parolees has also created doubts on the effectiveness of the rehabilitation program and parole system. That is a kidnap. The example that I can make here is the kidnapping and killing of an 8-year-old kid named Van Dijk by the alleged parolee. So a task team has been set by the minister, led by that, by Judge Desai, to review the system in order to close this gap. The possibility of amending the minimum detention period for sexual offences and certain aggressive offences is being considered as well.
For that presentation. Honorable members, I'm going to go straight without wasting your time. I'll deal with other incidentals later. You know our drill as the subcommittee on corrections. So, and there's been about 3 presentations made. We're going to shoot through your questions and clarities. And you can traverse the different. Our drill is you pose your questions, we don't go to the next member, they immediately respond to your issues, because we avoid leakages. So that you don't wait for the last one, you're waiting for your issues to be responded to. That is our drill as a subcommittee. You ask and they respond. Follow-ups can come later. Okay? We're not expecting you to make a speech. Perhaps we can agree anything between 5 to 8 minutes so that we have that closer interaction. So the better thing is for them to respond to your question. May I see, by show of hands, those interested to engage? I'll start with the Honorable Horn, followed by Honorable Aldemar, Honorable Hendricks, Honorable Glenis Breitenbach, that order. Honorable South. you wanted to remind me, you know, I know. And then Honorable Mohammed, Honorable Alma Drachen, and Honorable Mufukeng in that order. So every member is you better be ready to engage on this. let's kick start in that order. Honorable Horn, you the first out of the blocks.
Yeah, thank you, Jay. I want to focus firstly in the allowed time on the parolee situation. And I want to make a statement and also ask the department to respond, that it would seem to me their presentation centers much around the theory behind parole. But we're not informed as to the limitations, the weaknesses, the frustrations they have. So in terms of the information I've gathered, I want to give certain information I have, and then I want the department to respond to that. So firstly, I understand that in terms of their own internal service level standards in respect of social workers, they're supposed to have one social worker for every 240 inmates in the centres, and in terms of community corrections, they're supposed to have one social worker for every 120 persons either on parole or subject to community supervision. And my information is that nowhere is that service level standard adhered to. So for example, if we talk about parole then, I also understand that the impact is on slide 38 there, they themselves refer to the fact that there's supposed to be a parole, no sorry, it's not slide 38, it's slide 15. There's supposed to be a parole report, pre-report, to be compiled 6 months before somebody is up for a parole evaluation. And my information is that while social workers are supposed to work with inmates from day one, because of the fact that there's not enough social workers in the system, what happens now is 6 months before this parole evaluation or hearing, they get the list of those who are up for parole in 6 months, and then they start packing in the contact sessions with inmates in order to do the parole. And that obviously, it must follow that would defeat the whole purpose behind having social workers there if one looks at rehabilitation. So, for example, we have not seen in this presentation the struggles they have with rehabilitation programs, and my information is that while the contents are very good, obviously for the fact that there's not enough social workers in the system, they're heavily reliant on involving other officials. So there's this slogan going around, every employee is a rehabilitator. But then the question begs, to what extent do they have in-house measures, checks and balances to ensure that those who present these rehabilitation programs, if it's not the social worker, at least have a proper training to conduct these programs. Then if we look at social workers, and again the social workers, once people are out on parole, because they're not adhering to this standard of 1 to 120, my information is that where there is social workers, and that's more or less only in the urban centres or the bigger centres, the ratio is rather 1 to 800. Then their own, again, the service level standard says once you are released on parole, you're deemed to be a high risk, all parolees, for the first 6 months. And in that 6 months, you're supposed to get at least 4 home visits per month, which more or less can never materialise. And then, because the system says after 6 months, you are, if you have not transgressed, entitled to be downgraded to first a medium risk and then a low risk, there's no real way to see whether people have really complied with their parole, with the parole condition. So that the department on slide 38 says there's a 99% success rate, which I think is questionable. my information is that the 99% is based on the fact that as little as 1% of parolees are ultimately sent back to centers to complete their sentences there. But that doesn't mean that there's a 99% who really comply with their parole conditions. There's no real way the department can evaluate that. And that's where we get this fallout of people who ultimately hit the media by re-offending in a serious manner. Because whilst those who were convicted of sex crimes and other violent crimes are supposed to be the high risk offenders for the duration of their parole, after 6 months they also treated as if they are downgraded to medium and low risk offenders. So that's really the questions, and hopefully we can get answers. If not, I would urge that we must at some stage then get an honest presentation as to the challenges the department have with implementation. Because really, not to be rude, but what we saw today is the theory behind parole, and hopefully there's nobody who has a problem with the theory behind parole. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Horn. I'm trying to protect you so that you can immediately get answers so that before you prolong it.
Chair, maybe not on the point of order. I want to suggest something because we've got 30 minutes. We can look at the time. That we all pose our questions and we still have time to be answered in the next meeting.
I will manage.
I'm worried that with the way we are going, we have many questions and this thing, as Mr. Horn is saying, is very scary. We need to come up with actually way forward.
That's noted, but I'll manage. We stick to our dream. I will manage it. Can we get responses to Mr. Horn's questions? Commissioner, your team.
I'm going to get Ms. Mbandaba to respond, and then Ms. Moreni, and then I'll add it.
Thank you, Commissioner and honorable members. Maybe I need to start by accepting and agreeing the fact that we do not have enough social workers in the Department of Correctional Services. It is correct in terms of our service level standard that in Edge Community Corrections we have a total of 119 social workers in Edge Community Corrections. We also have 63 social workers that are assisting the social workers in terms of the intervention of the psychosocial programs that needs to be presented. And also we have a number of NGOs, NPOs and FBOs that we are working with to assist us to provide programs that we've entered into memorandum of understanding system to provide us with a reintegration programs. We do have our own spiritual care workers that are also assisting us in terms of providing the reintegration programs. But yes, in terms of if you look at the social workers in our centers versus the number of sentenced offenders that we need to provide programs, yes, we do have challenge there, and that is something that we will have to work on as a department to ensure that we capacitate our social workers. The issue of the number, perhaps the number of our monitoring officials versus the total number of our parolees and probationers that needs to be visited to ensure that we supervise them and monitor them. Yes, it is a challenge that we need to accept, but the 99% success rate, it's based on the fact that the total number of parolees and probationers that have not violated their conditions, it's reported as 99%, and all those that we have, all those that have not complied with the conditions, and we have provided our interventions before we revoke the parole, it constitutes a 1% that were revoked to our centers. Yes, maybe in terms of the capacity, we don't have enough capacity at Community Correction to ensure that we monitor the parolees and probationers as effectively as we should. But we do ensure that we consult with the communities,
we have around the country, as we have 218 offices around the country. On top of that, we have got 958 service points where we are servicing to ensure that we provide communities an opportunity to be able to talk to us as and when there is a parolee or a probationer that is giving problems within the community or is not adhering to the conditions. We also have a good relationship with our CPS, and whom we always request them to be our ears and eyes. And also in the faith-based sector, what we have done as a department in the last financial year, we have gone around the different provinces inviting a number of faith-based sectors, because we do believe that in every community there is a church. And the church is the area where, or is the institution that can assist us to ensure that we support, we provide support to the parolees and probationers, and those that are not adhering, they can be able to report those parolees back to us so that we can intervene as far as possible. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, while you were away, this committee was in good hands, and the acting chair made a very good ruling in response to a concern by a member of the Democratic Alliance, and she also asked that the matter be attended to before the end, before the honourable members go back to their stations. I have a similar problem. I'm new to Parliament. I didn't know that these matters must be raised at the beginning of the meeting. So with your indulgence, I would also like my matter to be attended to, Mr. Chair. As you know, the Parliamentary Constituency Office plays a very important role in Parliament. And we had a visit by three 80-year-old women about their sons who qualified for parole 2 years ago in terms of the minimum requirements, and they were granted a night parole, but they are still incarcerated, giving credence to the judgment of the Supreme Appeal Court that this is cruel, inhuman, and degrading. And I like the honourable member of the DA, I'd exercise my responsibility. I consulted another honourable member of this committee, and we spoke to the minister about this problem. I then wrote a question to the minister in the middle of February, and as you know, that we need an answer in 14 days. That has not been forthcoming. I raised the matter when I replied to the president's SONA address, and I also spoke to the inspecting judge, like the honourable member of the DA did, about this particular matter. And because this meeting was on the agenda, I thought that I will hold back and that I will raise it here and maybe get a quicker answer, because when I do my report to the Secretary of Parliament on the effectiveness of constituency offices, then certainly, you know, I would like to be very positive that the parliamentary constituency offices bring matters of the community to Parliament. I'm referring to three lifers who qualified parole about 2 years ago: Ibrahim Jenica, prison number 202534794. Abdullah Mansour, prison number 202534479, and Muhammad Isaac, prison number 99529125. I have to thank the committee in my confidence to say that I know Muhammad Isaac very well, since he was a teenager, because his father and myself worked together. And at the moment, he's doing exemplary service as being a librarian at Portsmouth Prison, and they love him. And I can't understand why, if they have qualified for parole, if their profile met all the requirements, and also if the three grandmothers were told, yes, your sons will soon be out on day parole, while they are still being incarcerated, giving, you know, just, you know, and that means Continued incarceration is cruel, inhuman, and degrading. I would like you to be as brave as your acting chairman and also ask the commissioner here to give us some answers.
I just want to give them answers if you don't now. So they respond directly to you.
Thank you.
Commissioner and team.
Thank you. I request the Honourable to provide the names of those serial offenders that you are inquiring about. And I also, again, need clarity from yourself whether were they considered by the parole board. Okay. So then when the offenders are considered for parole placement, it is not and when they qualify to be considered for parole consideration, it's not an automatic process that eventually the feedback will be approved parole placement. There are other lot of factors that are taken into consideration when the profile is placed before the decision made. However, you still have the right to be provided with the feedback in terms of that. So after you have provided us with the names, may I request that we revert back to you after this meeting when we get back to the office. Thank you.
Sorry, Chair. I've had
the consent of your mic, is
it? Honorable Hendricks indicating that he'd written. I'll just make sure. Follow on that. We are supposed to respond. I know that the matter was before the parole board and that there's a process. I thought it might be useful, Ms. Remy, to explain the process. Maybe Ms. Tsitswana. Yeah, just to talk about the process because I think that may assist.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Honourable. I think it's important to explain the actual parole process for offenders that are serving life sentences. There's different dispensations which describe the minimum detention period. The dispensation we can pick up from the number, the corrections number that you just, I heard you mention 99 something, 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 meaning that the offender was sentenced in 1999, meaning that he falls under what you refer to as the Van Wyk category. In terms of offenders that are serving life sentences, it is the discretion of the minister that approves parole. But minister, usually there's a committee that you probably know, which is called the National Council for Correctional Sentences. That's the committee that recommends to minister whether offenders should be paroled or not. And usually that committee sits once a month and it comprises of judges, magistrates, prosecutors, police, members of the community, etc. And it is only through, once the process has gone through them, then it only goes to the minister for recommendation. I think as my colleague has said, we will take the names, we will check for you on the system, and then we'll be able to provide you.
Thank you, Honorable Glenis. If you don't come for us, that's part of the deal. I wanted to thank you. I was ready to thank you.
Thank you.
Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you. I just want to, before I start, say that I think this engagement is much more important than the joint sitting, and we should stay here and finish our business, because that is what we're actually here to do. Then, on the questions asked by Honourable Horn, I align myself with this question, and I must say that your answer raises many more questions than it answered. And that position remains deeply concerning, because on your own admission then you have in the vicinity of 182 social workers, which I mean, I'm boggled as to how those few people are supposed to cope for this deluge of work. And how are we supposed to rehabilitate offenders and keep tabs on who they actually are, where they're going and what they're doing? If you have a budget that is continually being increased and you're using it for, I'm not at all sure what, and we'd have to interrogate that a little more carefully now, but for something as essential as this service,
is clearly not being provided. I'm very, very worried about that. And I'd like to suggest, Mr. Chair, that we hold a separate follow-up meeting on just that subject matter. Because that situation certainly can't be allowed to continue. You say you want to capacitate your social workers. But how? How do you capacitate when they aren't in? Who are you capacitating? You spoke about a 99% success rate and a 1% success rate. I'm not sure what you were referring to, but I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think you were saying 99% of parolees don't reoffend and 1% do. Do I understand you correctly? No? Okay, well then, please explain it to me. It also worries me that this sort of is becoming a community's problem. The faith-based sector must now keep tabs on people. The community policing forum, yes, those are institutions that can do that type of thing if and when it arises, but it surely isn't their job. It's the job of correctional services, and correctional services need to appoint suitably qualified people to do that job. It can never be the job of a community policing forum or the job of a faith-based sector to keep tabs on parolees and where they are and what they do. Of course, if somebody goes there and says it's a problem, that's a different matter. But it's a deeply unsatisfactory answer. Then you mention Section 63A of the Criminal Procedure Act, which allows the head of a correctional centre, under certain circumstances with regards to certain crimes, a discretion to seek the release or an amendment of bail conditions. I'd like to know if that's ever been done. If so, how many times? If not, why not? And I'd like that answer in particular reference to the children on bail for children on remand, where there's a child in custody who has bail of R400 that hasn't been paid. Why has this section not been used to assist in this situation? And even the child with R1,000, what are the charges that they're facing, and is there a reason why this section cannot be applied to assist in that instance? I was a prosecutor for many years, and I'm not soft on offenders at all, but I also know that R400 won't make anyone attend their trial if they're not going to. So to keep somebody in custody for R400 is just so counterproductive. Yeah. It's so counterproductive. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me at all. Then, under your services and programs for remand detainee children, you say a total of 2 remand children were involved in programs. 2? 2? What am I supposed to make of that figure? 2? Is it voluntary? Do you get to do what you want? If you don't, put the participation programs, are they not offered? 2? What are you going to do with 2? Then, also with regard to the 64 children on remand detention, why hasn't Section 63A been used for them as well? And then on parole, I have a question about the electronic monitoring devices, which seems to continue to come back and haunt us. So the electronic monitoring devices were fully and very thoroughly vetted before they were piloted. And there were no weaknesses in the system, I'm told. Despite every effort to poke holes in that system, none were found. This was a very successful system while it lasted. And that those tagging devices even came with mini solar panels as an add-on, which allowed for a testing device where you could test for substance and alcohol abuse at any given time, which would allow you to see who was blowing and what the result was. So those benefits were lost because correctional services, I'm told, did not enter into a maintenance or service agreement with the manufacturer. So is this true? Is this so? Why is this? And what is being done to rectify this situation? We spent a lot of money on those electronic tagging devices. I'm told that it is, while it lasted, is extremely successful. And I'd like to know why that is not being followed up on, and why an ostensibly very successful useful and helpful service has been abandoned. Thank you.
Thank you. Response, Commissioner, and your team.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to ask in sequence if Mr. Katenga to respond. I think it will be both to Honorable Vaughan's question and Honorable Berichtenbach, and then I'll have Ms. Mbandaba, and then Ms. Mlomo.
Yeah, I think with the issue of having the right skills and capacity in the right place for us to achieve the goal of corrections, we've realized that whilst the legislation changed and the regime changed from prison to corrections, operationally we have been slow in terms of catching up with that transition. So we've been busy with developing a service delivery model and business process mapping. And the aim of this exercise is to identify exactly that, to say what is the ideal number of the various areas of skills for rehabilitation and reintegration. So nurses, doctors, social workers, etc. And to get the right skills to be able to deliver effectively. Because currently we have got officials who are security trained or security oriented, filling in for some of these specialized skills, which is obviously, you know, counterproductive. So the end result of this exercise that we're doing is to say that we have security officials dedicated to the sphere of security within the corrections environment and within the community corrections environment. And then we establish what are the numbers required in the specialized areas, and then part of it is also to say how do we leverage off other government departments, because the extent of the varied skills would mean that we would need to get a basic education on board and get the Department of Health as well to assist us with resources to be able to deliver on the specialized areas. So it's work in progress, as I had indicated in the last presentation, but we will be revising the structure. And then the implementation will follow from there. So it is being addressed.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable Member, in terms of the 99%, I said it's people that comply with the conditions, not necessarily that it's people that do not commit crime. We do find in the 1% people that commit crime.
Thank you. May I have a follow-up question on that, because then I understand better. Thank you. Is reoffending, I presume, one of the conditions? I would have assumed that reoffending was one of the conditions of compliance with your
benefit. You know, we have, as I've admitted, we have a challenge of our parolees that are committing crime. We will know them when they come through the SAPS, and the SAPS informs us. Because in some instances you find that the parolees, when they commit crime, they use alias names. And that is very prevalent. And also in terms of our system, we don't have the integrated justice system, where we will know as soon as the offender has committed crime and being arrested. For example, if a person is arrested in another province, we do not have a system where we will be immediately picking up from our side. So that is something that integrated justice system is working on. And there are those gaps in the system that we are working on, but it's a work in progress.
I'm sorry,
Jim,
I just have one thing to say about
this. No, just pause. Thank you, Chair. With regard to the attendance of programs by the Remand Detainee Children, I don't remember in my state saying two children had attended programs. Yeah. But all the steps regarding the attendance of programs by the children is also included in the Child Justice Report, which is tabled in Parliament. So all the information that I use is that information, because I wanted to use the information that is already in space. But I I don't remember saying to those reports, they are already online because we've tabled the last report. Yeah. Then when it comes to referral to court, in terms of Section 63A, Section 63A, it does not have monetary values. Monetary values only apply to economic related crimes. It's fraud, forgery, and it's three of them. If theft, if the value is above 20,000, those people do not qualify. The biggest problem with us is that we submit applications to court for everyone who appear to qualify. By the time when we submit those applications, that person is having other charges that were not written in the warrant. So automatically, then a person falls off to qualify. So there are a lot of limitations from our side as DCS, which at a face value, it appears as if we do have this magic that we can use with 63A. And 63A also, another limitation is that we use it on the third month. We agreed with the judiciary because the judiciary said, DCS, I cannot sentence a person and give a person bail. Tomorrow we are submitting an application for bail review. So we're using that month based on the research that we did. How long does it take for more than 70% of our dues to pay bail? We discovered that first 2 months, a lot of them, they paid bail. So hence we use then the third month for submitting the application. But even those that have submitted the applications for, at times by the time court comes back to us to give a date, this person has already paid bail. So the bail payment process, it continues, it takes place at the first 2 months, at the third month, at the fourth month. So you can never predict when will be the RD be able to pay bail. So, but because you see this figure, you think we've got people that have been here. No, these are the people that are admitted on a regular basis in the system. That is shown also by our stats when we do the analysis of the RDs. That 53 to 55% of our RDs are there for between a day and 3 months. And you don't see these people shifting to other categories, which means we've got people that are coming in and out, coming in and out, coming in and out. Unfortunately, even your bail figures are just embedded in that number. Though there are people that have paid bail, it does not show because the figures, they remain constantly high your first 3 months. Thank you.
Just to reflect on the electronic monitoring, I need to indicate that I was briefed that the system wasn't as successful, but apart from that, the actual contract was under investigation by the SIU, and it was, and there's a court case currently undergoing between the SIU, DCS is a party there too, and there's claims and counterclaims. So the reason that the electronic monitoring has ceased is as a result of the actual investigation with regard to the SIU. I think also just to reflect on the our service delivery model and our operational management framework, we are in the final processes of ensuring that we do the microstructure of the organization. The organization's design is outdated, so there's misalignment throughout the organization. So with the service delivery model, as well as us finalizing operational management framework, we are hoping to ensure that we have the appropriate skills in the appropriate places. So it's not just around the issue of social workers, it's around the issue of criminologists, pentologists, and all of that. So there's a range of professional services that is required within the service. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I don't mean to be nasty, but two people have mentioned work in progress. It's now, you know, since 2005 we accepted the white paper on corrections. It's now 15 years later, and we still work in progress about transforming the correctional system to one centered on rehabilitation and reintegration. I also, the other thing that's work in progress is the integrated justice system. mean, how many years have we been talking about it? And I guarantee that many of the people that are released on parole and rearrested aren't registered as being one and the same person for that precise reason. But I think, as my colleagues have said, that the system works well in theory, it doesn't work well in practice. And that is because, I mean, let's talk about the skill shortages. According to the annual report of the department, as of 31st March 2019, the DCS employed only 7 doctors, 81 psychologists and vocational counsellors, and 594 social workers. That's for a prison population of about 160 odd thousand people. Well, you can go and do the maths. I mean, it means that, precisely as you said, that non-professional people, lay people essentially, will be doing assessments of extremely vibrant and very maladaptive personalities. So, I mean, what you are finding here, that there's a whole slew of people who don't go through any evaluation at all, people who are serving short sentences. And then of the people who are serving long sentences, there are very, very few who will undergo psychological evaluation, even if you have service-level agreements with other organizations. And the people who then make the decisions on whether or not somebody should be released on parole are lay people themselves, community supervision and parole board members are chosen because of their standing in the community, not because of their professional assessment about whether the person's been rehabilitated. So you're having the amateurs relying on other amateurs to give an agreement about whether or not somebody should be released on parole. Probably the biggest single thing that troubles us is the fact that despite ostensibly high figures of offender-victim mediation or dialogue, it doesn't seem to be working well. I mean, I can just refer you to the Hewitt case that I believe is now being reheated up. But it was apparently the case that the complainants, which are covered by 299A, I think it is, of the Criminal Procedure Act, because it's a sexual offences offence that was committed, were not informed that Mr. Hewitt was applying for parole. And only afterwards, when they raised an objection, was the decision taken back on review. Now, I really don't believe that every victim of every crime is consulted before a parole board takes a decision. And I accept that it's difficult to do, but then don't try and say that it's happening when it's not happening. Finally, I'd just like to know what the level is, and it links on to what my colleague Mr. Horn said about the supervision of parolees after release, and particularly after they've been downgraded. Because I think you, ma'am, were very kind to give me the information last time we met about the alleged killer of Casimir von Fake, who was a parolee who had in fact absconded. He was not to be. He'd been registered as an absconder and yet not rearrested. And I imagine that once you get registered as an absconder, you tell the police that. But what's the police? They've got hundreds of other things to do. And I'd like to be assured, bearing in mind, again, the figures of people working in community corrections, what sort of supervision, what's the caseload for an average correctional supervision officer in terms of the number of parolees and probationers that he or she has to supervise. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Self. Can I get responses?
I will respond on the issue of victim participation in the parole board. It is true that we are not reaching out to every victim, basically because our systems with the justice are not integrated. So when the offender are due to be considered at the parole board, sometimes we experience difficulties in terms of tracing of the victims if they did not register at our parole board. And we are also intending to improve on that. Thank you.
No, when do you know when they will be integrated? But that's the point that has been raised. It's always been a work in progress. Maybe the next lesson will respond.
Yes, yeah. Well, just in terms of the whole integrated justice system taking off, I think there's that concern has been registered by Minister Lamola to say that progress has been slow. And I think it is that in conjunction with the integrated criminal justice strategy, those two bodies, as it were, have come under scrutiny, and he has indicated that the progress must improve drastically. So I think we'll see some better traction in this current financial year, or in the coming financial year.
Playing for that traction, or are you hoping for it?
It will most likely materialize.
You're still not answering my question. Is that planned for,
yes,
or
it is.
You're hoping it will happen?
It is planned for.
Okay.
Yes. And the structures have been put in place to drive that.
All right.
Yes.
Remember, later on we're going to your APPs and I'll be watching the space. But the next, any other response, Commissioner?
I will respond, Chair, on the ratio of monitoring officials on terrorism and probation. Currently, with the total number, as my colleague has mentioned, that we are working on the alignment of the
structure. When you get closer to it?
We are currently is 1:40 parolees and probationers. But what we must also take into consideration that it is unlike the center because we are not in the four walls. There's distances that are taken into consideration, how far is the geographical distribution of that particular area per monitoring official.
The ministers also indicated that we are reviewing the parole system. So part of that is to ensure that we become more victim-centric, so that we move away from emphasis on the perpetrator. As part of that process, we are doing a pilot in the Western Cape, where six offenders that qualify for parole within 6 to 12 months, we are sharing the details with the police so that we are able to get docket information, where we can get the victim statement and other details so that we, when we submit to the parole board, they have sufficient information and not just the normal SAP 62 and SAP 69 that is very superficial in description of crime. Chair, thanks.
Okay. We're noting in the table here. We'll proceed to the next speaker.
Thank you very much, Chair. My apologies if I could be after this call.
Just shoot straight to your question.
Yeah, no, I'm just going to apologize to the committee. Thank you. Just on the latter part, which you referred to, the Tasney conveyance matter, people with a profile such as Pangaka, who absconded, and I hear the commissioner referring to the pilot project, which is good. But obviously, meanwhile, life goes on. Are there a protocol or directive issued with specific emphasis on following up through what our chain in the JSPS, to the police in particular, when there's absconding? Who follows up when that is detected? Are there instructors to that effect in the form of a directive or circular, I assume, or is it all awaiting a particular pilot operationally? I assume the commissioner issued something like that after that incident, because this is not new, as we know. It's always difficult in the system when it comes to cohesion in our JCPs. Then, secondly, just to, as someone who has been part in fact leading this pilot protocol when we chaired this proceeding and started 2009 in my capacity in justice at the time, it was for this very reason, particularly special emphasis were also among many other sections, 63A, which Honorable Weisenbach raised already the question I wanted to ask. But taking it further, we said it must be reviewed, and the river is still there, the back of the protocol, every 5 years. And then we said there must be training for heads of prison in particular, because we know that there's a fine balance of a court director remanding training when it comes to trial, as opposed to an administrative process. And I know personally many heads are very reluctant to utilize it for fear of hurt. Now, but despite that, we see the figures of 5,000, it's quite large, every bench spends, we know, it's critical to show in the country demanding training. Maybe there's not today, Section 63A figures, how many has been considered, and is there any challenges in that regard? We don't have it today. Then, coming to Chair, lastly, just really basic information. How many victims and offenders participate in the victim-offender dialogue? One would also want to know how many applications, in terms of your presentation, which has been guided here, how many applications for political parole were reviewed or received in the last financial year, 2019-2020, and how many of those were approved, and how many were rejected, and how many perhaps inmates passed on from the applications before it could be reviewed. Just those two questions. Thank you.
Thank you. A great bite.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to respond to the 63A issues. The base protocol was reviewed. Initially, it was a 2009. We reviewed it. It was signed off the revised version in 2012. But the reason for review, we felt like the DCS, the Department of Correctional Services official, they had to specify which option should the court choose for each and every remand detainee application that we were submitting. Then we felt that was not safe. What if you choose an option with little information that you have about this remand detainee, and then when a remand detainee does all this funny thing outside, because you don't know, you don't have any information about this case, we rather have a blanket submission of the application, because the court has got all the facts regarding this very same case, including the previous history of crimes, then it must be the court that makes a decision. That was, the review was more about that. But with the very same base protocol, we have unpacked it further. There is a departmentally policy document. There are presentations, there are forms. Even all that information, we share it in the cluster. NPA does have the very same documents, the caseflow structures of the judiciary, they are having the very same documents. So on its own, 63A as a provision has not changed. What we are experiencing is the success rate that is poor. Yeah. So exact information is included in slide 17. I've included the trend analysis from 2015-16 to 2019-20. And I've even explained that we had a session with the magistrate where our session also included the results of the section 63A. And we pleaded with them that if we're having such poor results, then it's not helping us with the reduction management of the remand detainees. With us, unfortunately, as DCS, we are dependent on court with regard to this one. and also if the facility is new, is not overcrowded, 63A does not apply. We visited even with some magistrates. I remember when we were in Free State, the magistrate said, I've been waiting for Section 63A, but the facility that we visited said, no, you don't need to use 63A here. If the facility is not overcrowded, does not have problems, you cannot use it because it's clear the conditions for using 63A. Okay.
With regard to the protocol where offenders have absconded, there was no communication that was issued recently. However, we have the G3.
There was communication. So I just want to correct. You can answer the rest. I will respond on the
communication. Go ahead with the rest. You've got the directive.
There is a G306 warrant that is issued by the head of community corrections in cases where the offender have absconded. The matter is then, the case is then open with the staff to assist in tracking that offender. And then can I just, I respond to the questions of the totals of, you mentioned medical parole and victim participation and what else? Only those two. Okay. Can maybe someone respond to another question, then I will respond later on those.
I'll respond on the participation of victims in the victim offender dialogue and victim offender mediation. We have seen an increase, as stated in slide 44, we have seen an increase on the victims participating in the victim offender dialogue. In the third quarter of this current financial year, we've reported in 18,598 victims who participated against the total of 8,598 of offenders who participated. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Director, I'll just have to follow through why it's not known. But we've sent a directive that all offenders that abscond, parolees that abscond, that must be reported within 24 hours to head office. Where we've got a special capacity that's going to deal and respond to that so that we can interface with the South African Police Service at the national level. So that has been communicated.
You need to sort that out in house, because every one of you must be a messenger. Okay, thank you. Can we get to you, Valma, Honorable Draven? And then we, from there, to move. Okay, Honorable Simang, any issue you want to raise? Questions? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. My questions have been reduced a bit, but I do still have a few issues. One of the responses said the parolee was not registered. So I'm concerned about that response. He absconded, but he wasn't registered as absconded. So I don't know if I misunderstood that. Does it mean that every parolee that goes before the parole board, you know, sometimes the department does not register them before they leave the center? Is that what that means? I just need clarity on that point. And then question, the parole board. The third point, it says the DCS representative hyphen also acting as the secretary. So yes, that is in the Act, but I'm concerned about that. My concern is that sometimes in the newspaper, you know, it would be said that the parole board are not competent. So that's why parolees abscond, reoffend. So I would like to know about this, the third person on the board, the DCS representative. Are they only there to act as a secretary, or are they also there on the board to advise, the rest of the board what can be done, what can't be done, etc.? So that's my first question. Secondly, so community members, two community members on the board. The community members, are they from NGOs or are they just any community members that are put on the board? And I ask this because during the presentation you said sometimes you can't trace the victim. So I'm wondering then, on the board, it should be an NGO that sees two victims. Maybe there is one, maybe there isn't one, I don't know. But we need an organization that works with victims, victims of abuse, of assault, of gender-based violence, if they can be on the board. So they can be the early warning system that, okay, the person is approved for parole, they can assist DCS to contact the family, contact everybody who needs to know that an offender has been given parole. Because we always hear that the family or the victim didn't know that that offender was up for parole. Or so if the NGO is there on the board, on the parole board, they can be the eyes and ears and work with the victims as well. So that was my second question. Then thirdly, in relation to children in remand in the facilities, I'm very concerned about the children. You said 56% don't attend school. You've given us a whole list, you know, of why and how many, but I would like to know who works with these children and why don't they attend to school? Maybe it's because they commit a crime because they don't attend to school. So you say the first person that they meet is a social worker, not a psychologist. So if those 56%, those children, get psychological assessment for why they are not in school, maybe they have a learning disability. Maybe that's why they couldn't stay in school. What happened to them? That's why they couldn't stay in school. Give them real assistance. And real encouragement so they can go back to school and stay in school. And the list that you gave, the 30 children, it doesn't give an age. So we don't have an age range, you know, are they younger than 14, older than 14? I'd just like to get an idea of the age range in the ones, the 30. One more, Jay. I don't see the numbers of educators in your presentation. Do you have enough educators, teachers, to teach the children? Because if outside the center we can have homeschooling, then why do you have a challenge here? So I'd like a follow-up on how many educators in DCS. Thank you, Chair.
Good responses? Who's responding?
I will respond on the parole board members, with the secretary of the parole board, who is the DCS member. Let me maybe just give a brief background of why is it only this member who is a permanent member of the DCS. Our parole administration previously, it used to be dominated by DCS officials. So it was criticized to say that parole administration is not transparent. Then the parole system was revised, and then members of the parole board were now appointed from the members of the community. So the parole board secretary is also not there to take minutes, but he is also a member, full-time member of the board, who also participates in decision-making and provide also advice to the parole board. What was the next question? Okay, the community members. The community members, the requirement is that they should also be having experience in community development work.
So due to the geographic location of our parole board, it's not always practical to have members of the community who are serving the closest community that is closer to their parole board. Like, I will make an example of Kroonstad Management Area. It has got 14 centers that are being served by one parole board. So that parole board is roving to other parole, to other centers that are far from the main management area where the parole offices are. So it is not always practical to for the community members to know the community of the areas where they are roving to. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. On the, I can respond on the issue of the victims, the tracing of the victims. We used to depend on the NGOs to trace the victims, and we had challenges, a number of challenges, because some of the NGOs did not have enough budget to do the tracing. So we have managed to appoint the three social auxiliary workers to also assist us with the NGOs to trace the victims. And in that, we have been, that work, and it has been now improved, working also with SAPS in terms of getting us information to trace the victims. But as my colleagues have mentioned, that in most of the cases, we find that when you find the victims, you find them at a stage where they will say, you want to come and open the old wounds that are already buried. I do not want you to participate, or I do not even want you because I've moved on with my life. This incident happened 10, 20 years back. I am married and I've moved on. I don't even want that to be my children or my family now to even know what has happened. So that are some of the challenges that we have to respect when the victim doesn't want to participate. And also some of them, we find that we have to start the process, and they think that, can I then be allowed to go through the counseling before I can start to say, I will participate and I will be ready. Let me work with a psychologist or the therapist or my priest or whoever the person that they are comfortable with before they can be able to have energy and to go and face their perpetrator. So that is the work that is being done around that. But also we are working with the Victim Empowerment Forum to assist us with the social development and as well to assist us in the tracing of the victims. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner?
The registration of parolees, when offenders are placed on parole, they are being transferred from the correctional center into the system of community corrections. So they are admitted there, hence they are keeping their information. Thank you.
Okay. Can we go to Honorable Mfuke?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the more, I must welcome the presentations, the more they explain on the parole board how it was composed, it just gives one a problem. Because you are looking at a chairperson, is a committee member, a vice is a committee member, and then you have the third person being a secretary, and two other people are part-time committee members. But your quorum for that meeting to decide on important matters is three. So it can be two community members and your secretary. And really, this actually says that the minister's announcement of reviewing the parole board system or the parole system is very important because it doesn't make sense. And I have also checked on the qualifications of these people. And when I look at that, and I said to myself, there's no truth in that.
because I know of somebody who served in a parole board with just a matric, and unfortunately that person later went to actually be somewhere. And I kept on asking, how do you become part of this? But it also goes to say that is there any collaboration between the Department of Social Development or yourself or with Social Workers Forum, and then so that you can be able to work together to get things going? Because we have a lot of social workers that are not working, graduates, that can be used in many things, many ways. And then you look at this composition. You don't have a social worker, you don't have a psychologist. What is the expertise of these people in this regard? That is one that is worrying. Then we go to the issue that was raised by also Honorable Breitenbach. I am actually going to suggest to the chair that we still need to go deeper into this on the bail of 400 and 1,000. I mean, if you keep a person with a bail of 400, but the department spends more than 400 a day for a person, what is that? I mean, we need to look at that and say, where are we going? Because for that 1,400 people staying there for a very long time, it doesn't make sense. We need to look at how we go better into this. Chair, there's a worry that is there on the notorious cases. They are saying that they look at the type of crime committed, circumstances under which the crime was committed. They look at the status of a victim when crime was committed. And we talk about 434 people. But the problem will be with me, and I really need an explanation. Why, when a person has messed up, has committed crime, you have to tell us about the political standing of a person and the social standing? Where do they come? And the media coverage is not important. What is important is what the victims are suffering. I don't think these are really things that we have to check on. Because the minute we go on checking on this, then you will be scared to actually deal with a politically connected person or a socially connected person with money. It can't be right. This one, I think, Chair, when we deal with other things, it should not be the thing that people must forfeit their standings into all this minute you commit crime. We look at the scary, notorious cases, Gauteng and Western Cape. Gauteng is 154 when you come to the issue of life sentences. And then Western Cape. I mean, really, we really need to go on to this a lot, as we said, with members that will be visiting these areas. But the other information that is very scary, that I think it was there on the slide, the victim participation. This issue of victim participation, it says as if you are doing something about it. You are doing nothing, I can tell you now. The issue of Bob Hewitt, I'm the person who phoned the minister on the East Commissioner. And I said, this man cannot be out. And I raised the issue because the victim phoned me to say this is going to happen, with details, with everything, with a letter from one of your officials. So you can see that your parole board, there's something that is not happening. And my experience with that is that people with money, people with standing, as I'm saying, politically connected or social standing, they are always getting favors of going out. And that is where one needs to be saying that it must stop somewhere. You don't have even this thing of saying that you are contacting the victim. There's nothing like that. If there was something like that, so many people would have refused people that are outside. But you don't have a system, and we must agree. And if you had a system, you wouldn't have a Van Wyk's daughter being actually dead. You wouldn't have had a serial killer of Oliver Lord Bosch of 2004-06, Richard Nyauza, who came out of prison on a parole and came out to kill 16 women. And what do we call that? Those are things that you were supposed to learn from things that happened before and all that. Then you look at your challenges. Your challenges are saying a lot, and they are very disturbing, because one of the challenges, you are saying court judgments which have found some of the provisions relating to parole to be unconstitutional. Really, it says that there are a lot of things that are not right when you find the constitutional court going that way. Then you also go and say shortages of social workers. But social workers and psychologists are many. that are not working, and we know, and it has been said, that there are many. And you are saying you have also less, I think you are saying that you, I think there's a slide that disturbs that you are not talking about your internal matters. And your internal matters is when you don't care about your own. You were in saying that the Ashanti officials are not interested, or you don't have enough of them. That's okay. Lack of dedicated personnel to effectively monitor parolees. You know why? Because most of your officials have been killed. And it's a fact. For those who have been next to families that work for correctional services and with their own being killed, you have to list it as a challenge and say, what are we going to do next? Because we are human beings also. Talk about yourself. It's a challenge. And then from there, we'll be able to talk about the unemployed of parolees and probationers. It's not actually a priority. These people had challenges, but lack of readily available information of victims for participation in the restoration justice program. Honorable Velma was right to say, where are the NGOs? You spoke about the churches, and I don't think even the churches is their responsibilities, but we have a responsibility to make relations with the communities and the families so that we get these people to be on their with their families. We cannot come and say people don't want to actually accept one of their own or some of their own people back into their families. They are their children. And I'm sure that as time goes on and we move to be harsher with the law and the policies, people will understand that once you give birth to a child, whatever mistakes or whatever is going to happen, you take a responsibility. At the moment, there are a lot of women that are in trouble because of now there's transparency in this government, talking about their past of being molested, and then the molesters are still out there, and we don't talk about them. And we need to take those cases serious as they come, and those people are not supposed to get parole. Thank you.
Goes first.
Okay, I would like to provide clarity in terms of the challenges, the challenge specifically on the court judgment. In this matter of the PASA, as correctional services, when we determine the legislation that is applicable for an offender to serve a prescribed minimum detention period, our main focus was on the date of sentence. So with this judgment, we were ordered now to go back and look at the date of committal of the sentence. So that is why the matter was referred back to court. But the practice with correctional services has been that we are focusing on the date of sentence. So from now onwards, the consideration of offenders on parole will be determined by the period in which the crime was committed, no longer the date of sentence. However, when we calculate the duration of the period that needs to be served, we will use the date of sentence. But in terms of the minimum detention period to be served, it will be determined by the date of committal.
Thank you for the question. For me, I just want something for the committee to take note of. The whole legislative and policy framework regarding parole is challenged by the offenders. And as it is challenged by the offenders, unfortunately, the changes, through the Constitutional Court ruling, they benefit the very same offenders.
and the Department of Correctional Services has got no option but to oblige. But let me make an example. Like, if you are a lifer and you are having a determinate sentence, then the very same offense, there is a case law that a person cannot be given a sentence without life in South Africa. So, which means people will be placed on parole. Parole is included as a part of the punishment system in South Africa. And parole is a gradual reintegration. So some people are given a life sentence and a determinate sentence. If you are given a life and a determinate sentence, maybe of 170 years, but the determinate sentence is subsumed by the life, which means life becomes the core for making the decision. But unfortunately, the South African legal system, if you are a lifer, it allows you to serve a minimum sentence. There is, you have to be considered to be placed under the parole system, though you become a client of the Department of Correctional Services for life. So it would be easy to blame the Department of Correctional Services, but Correctional Services is implementing the law, and some of these things are court judgment. So we get all these punishments based on us implementing the law as is. Thank you. I thought I must really make that clear.
Next. Can you please respond, sis?
I just want to respond or deal with the issue of the appointment of parole board members. I think you're correct in what you're saying, that previously the requirements were not as stringent as they are now. And I'm sure you would have noticed now, recently, with the past advert, which was a year and a half ago, and also the recent advert as well, that there's a lot of stress on getting people with experience within the criminal justice system, and also a chairperson and vice chair, and also to get, you know, retired judges, magistrates, etc., to actually sit and be part of this, exactly for that reason that you just raised. Because if you don't have the proper qualifications, as a chairperson of the parole board, I mean, you need to engage documents, you need to engage judgments, sentences and remarks, SAP 6269, etc. So if you don't have that proper qualification, it becomes very difficult. And then also with the, you also spoke about the issue of the quorum as well. The Act does say that it needs to be a minimum of three, but also over and above that, it says that there has to be a chairperson or a vice chair that also sits. So you wouldn't find a situation where it's just community members and a secretary. There has to be at least a chair or a vice, and then the other members as well. Thank you.
Making a point, if the chair is community, the deputy is community, the secretary is community, that's the point I was making in relation to the quorum. Suppose you're saying your minimum is two. It's three. So it could be those three.
The member of the community means that it's people that are not departmental members. So one can be a member of the community but be a retired judge or retired chairperson. Or you can be a member of the community but with experience, for example, in the criminal justice.
I have to rephrase it and say civil society, because
yes,
the two are not the same.
Yeah, maybe
the member of community is not a judge.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Judge is part of the civil society. So we're going to need to clean that definition.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Okay. Next.
Maybe on the issue of, are you in collaboration with the councils that govern or regulate social workers? Yes, we are, because all our social workers are registered with the social work council. And yes, as my colleague has indicated, that the alignment of the organizational structure is in progress. So we are, the number of social workers, or let me say professionals, is taken care of. It will be considered today. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I must maybe indicate that we found the session useful because it assists us in engaging with the subject matter more rigorously. The only issue, there may be some issues that were not responded to I'm going to indicate that we'll respond in writing, Chair. But I think we'll have to come back and indicate about the process in terms of the reviewing of the parole system at large. There is going to be a process within the next 3 weeks where the ministers ask Judge Desai to convene a symposium to engage on the parole system. So I think that is going to assist us to fast track the matters around parole. We've noted the concern, but I can indicate that as a team we are working vigorously to ensure that we create better alignment in terms of responding to our mandate. That's all at this point. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, Commissioner. Maybe members, before we wrap up and close, just to say a few things up front as part of what we're expecting. I'm happy, Commissioner, you made that point, and we'll determine a definite date for that. It's clear that there is a need for you to come back to us, because by and large, issues here are systemic in their nature, the problems that we're having here. Whether you're talking about the electronic system, things that are not happening, and whether it's about lack of monitoring, and they give rise to all sorts of things. And so we are going to be interested in that so that we move away from ticking the box about what we get from presentations. And we're consistent with this. Judge Cameron, when was here with JIGS, we did the same thing. The first time the department was here, we highlighted a few things. And so the point here that we must make, and I'm glad you went into that point, because I was going to make the point that we are going to summarize the issues as we have had them as a committee. Because we want a very clear roadmap about the parole review process with timelines, so that we don't start another work in progress, as Honorable Self and members have said here. So if you're saying to us, the minister has got a 3 weeks process that he has, we're going to give you a date in 4 or 5 weeks' time for you to come here. And with you tell us exactly. Because there are critical things that Honorable Horn raised about things that are not happening, but that are supposed to happen. Which if they don't, and the answers to that are not satisfactory, if those things are not happening, we can't hope for things to pan out in the way that it should be. And so we would want to really do that. And those time frames will include these recruitment plans, because many of the skills that you want, you don't have. You need to come and say to us, because somebody was saying, but the psychiatrist or whoever, they are unemployed. So you can't come and present and say it's a scarce skill or we don't get it. It's going to be important that we have a second interaction with you on those specific issues. And we're going to list and give to you for you to prepare. On the legislation around the law, you know, when you came to us on the 21st of February, our very first meeting of this year, we took you through a roadmap of this committee that says for 22 issues that we're going to be attending to. Number 22 of those issues is legislation. Again, we said to JIGS, share with us what your proposed amendments of legislation and the things that are not helping you. So if you're complaining about the law, you must come and tell us. And you need to be to have put that down. What are these kind of bottlenecks in the law? Because that item of legislation is about us looking at CSA, your Correctional Services Act, and where there are issues there. And we said to them, come back with proposed amendments. What are those kind of things? So we develop a program around that. We deal with those things. By now, we want you, on issue of the parole, shouldn't be talking general. The President has spoken.
is made a policy statement. You can't be all over the place. You need to come to us and say, these are the exact areas that we think needs to be fixed. Unless you have not done that, or you're not in that space, or you want the committee to do that. So I'm saying we have got those 22 areas, and because of the nature of the importance of some of these things, we might want to postpone some other than bring forward those that are going to be kind of unlocking the path that we want to. So remember what we said, it's just a pity today that we were destabilized about the timing. We declared on the 21st of February, Friday is our correctional services day. You are either here or we are on site, sometimes unannounced, or we are with jigs. So there's now no excuse. You have a menu from us of the kind of things that we want to do. So perhaps without wasting your time, we're going to work with the committee secretary and take the issue that members have raised. Because with the time allocated, some members wanted follow-ups on their issues, and I had to stop them. And Fridays are not meant for that. If we meet at 9, we want members to exhaust their issues. But today was a bit difficult. So I want to apologize on that as well to members. So we just want to, because I think what we also want to change now, we want to move away from this thing is in process, is en route to the minister, is in progress. That kind of language, very soon, so that you know, at least as long as I'm chairperson, we're not going to listen to that language. Gives us something else. So don't come with all roads. This is work in progress. It's got to be specific. Work in progress, where is the thing? And he's committed, Katenga, and we've noted that down on the integration of. And the next time we will call that, and we've committed with time as well. We want that. You must tell us when you are not able. Here is a failure immediately. Don't drag us along. We're not interested to just travel with you. We're interested to see results of the work that we're doing as a committee. We don't want to look back after 5 years and we are a step of the members of parliament who are in a committee, but we can't pick up a legacy of things that are tangible and that the committees can get hired with. You paid to do that, by the way. We paid to make these kind of things that we're making. So with those words, I want to summarize the meeting. Apologies for me joining you late. I got involved in a multiple clash on the L1. Before I close, Honorable Sir.
Yes, Chair. Before you arrived, I raised an issue, and I just wondered whether the National Commissioner had an answer for me.
Okay. On that, Peter? No, I know. The report has come, but I can't open it on the bookshelf. So as soon as I'm able to access it, that secret seems to be classified. Thank you. But as soon as I'm able to access it, then I'll make a bit of. So that's your electronic system live, not working. Wow.
Yeah, I think that's load shedding. It's with load shedding that we have a problem.
All right. Okay, that's fine. Anyway, thank you very much, members. We welcome, we're happy to be with you, Honorable Hendricks. That's a committee that you must participate on. And welcome, Honorable Mr. Mang, and for joining us, and Honorable Mwala. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.